I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, new information has been made available to the public in the Trayvon Martin case. Trayvon Martin, of course, is the unarmed Florida teen who was shot and killed by self-appointed neighborhood watch volunteer George Zimmerman. Florida authorities have released photos, an autopsy report on the teenager, and a new witness account. So we've asked NPR's Greg Allen to walk us through it in just a few minutes. But first, we want to talk politics. Today, the presumptive GOP presidential candidate Mitt Romney releases his first campaign ad for the general election.
What would a Romney presidency be like? Day one, President Romney immediately approves the Keystone Pipeline, creating thousands of jobs that Obama blocked. President Romney introduces tax cuts and reforms that reward job creators, not punish them.
And there's more. But the Romney campaign has not aired commercials since his top Republican challenger, Rick Santorum, dropped out of the race last month. Mr. Romney has vowed to run a clean and positive campaign, which he says contrasts with the Obama campaign, which he says is focused on character assassination. But this ad comes on the heels of news that wealthy GOP investors funding a super PAC proposed an Obama smear campaign, which planned to resurrect the connection between President Obama and his former pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright Jr. At the center of the news, conservative multi-billionaire Joe Ricketts, founder of TD Ameritrade. Ricketts commissioned the $10 million advertising plan along with others pending approval. Joe Ricketts now says a proposal to use Reverend Wright in commercials was never set in motion and those ads will not air. But he still says he's going to fund a multi-million dollar effort to unseat Mr. Obama this November. We wanted to talk more about this and the state of the race in general. So we've called upon Michael Fauntroy. He is author of the book Republicans and the Black Vote. He's a professor of public policy at George Mason University. He's here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for joining us. Thank you very much. Also with us, Lenny McAllister. He is a senior contributor to Politic365.com and a former Republican National Committee strategy consultant. He's a sought-after commentator. Lenny McAllister, welcome back to you.
Thanks, Michelle. How are you?
Great. Now, Lenny, I'm going to start with you because even though Mr. Ricketts says that they are not going to go forward with this ad campaign, one part of it caught our eye. It says that, I'm using quotes here, and the campaign proposed hiring an extremely literate conservative African-American as its spokesperson. Now, that sounds like you. Did they approach you for this task? Did you know about this?
No, because I probably didn't fit into the metrosexual part of the adjective and description that they had in there as well.
Metrosexual?
Yeah. If you see the whole thing, it was metrosexual, attractive, eloquent, this, that, and the other African-American conservative that they were going after. And no, I wasn't approached for that. And I wouldn't have done something along those lines. Trying to do this and trying to play the race card that conservatives say that we hate so much and then trying to use it in order to chip away the African-American vote is a bad strategy. It was something that would have just alienated black voters from the Republican Party, not just in 2012, but probably for 2014 and 2016 and 2018 as well. I think the more appropriate strategy, and if they were to ask me for my advice, would be to less try to do an Obama on the other side to counter President Obama. It's to use his own words. I mean, rather than using Jeremiah Wright, use the guns and religion statement. Use the fact that there are a lot of African-American ministers and preachers that are against his stance on gay marriage. Let's talk about the fact that President Obama has been able to be a little bit of everything for all people, but he's had a very hard time really embracing the title of the first black president and being able to be seen as being close to that voting bloc despite the 97% of voting loyalty that he had in 2008.
In fact,
Those are the strategies they should be going at.
Let me just jump in here and say that you wrote a blog post about this saying to our African-American voters, President Obama, he's just not that into you, which is your take on it. But Michael Fauntroy, I want to pick up on something that Lenny McAllister said. He seems to believe that this was aimed at African-American voters. Do you?
No. In fact, I don't think that there's anything Republicans can do to target African-American voters in this election cycle that will make any significant impact on the lessening the number of votes that go to President Obama or increasing the number of votes that go to Governor Romney. The fact of the matter is this ad was targeted toward people who can be racially primed and encouraged to consider President Obama in racial terms and to just continue to support and validate their own suspicions about who he is and what he's about.
But and were those people going to vote for President Obama anyway?
Yes, but there's still people, believe it or not, who are undecided about which way they're going to go. And some people can be reached through this kind of coded language or not so coded language. And by bringing up this proposal, in some respects, they get what they want anyway. That is to get people to remind people about Jeremiah Wright without actually having to commit the funds or actually putting their money behind criticizing Obama's connection to Wright. So they get what they want without actually having to do what they wanted to do.
Now, the presumptive GOP nominee Mitt Romney responded to the news even before Joe Ricketts made his statement that he was not going to go forward with this. And this is what he told reporters after a campaign rally. This is yesterday.
Having a campaign focused on character assassination is one of the things I find offensive, among many others, in the PAC description that came in the New York Times. If that's accurate, why, obviously, that's something I repudiate.
Well, so, Michael, you're reacting to this.
Is this the same Mitt Romney whose PACs piled on Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum with millions of dollars in South Carolina? I mean, what exactly is he talking about? You know, this is insane. Ultimately, if he's going to take the position that he's not going to support this kind of stuff, then he's likely to lose.
Well, Lenny, what do you say about that? And if you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News.
I agree with the professor. I mean, this is Newt Gingrich was up by double digits in Iowa until he got carpet bombed in Iowa, and Newt never recovered. He had a little bit of a blip in South Carolina, and that was it. He did the same thing with Rick Santorum and misrepresented some of Rick Santorum's record. But what he had to do, though, and he was trying to do this the same way, is speak against the super PAC and then allow them to do all of his dirty work. I mean, that's what he did. He had a parallel strategy. Let the super PACs do their work, and then he'd come in behind it, say, I have no control over that money, but I'll benefit from all the results. Now, with that said, do I think that it's going to play a matter in this race? Absolutely. This is not going to go anyplace.
What's the that? You mean race?
Linked.
Wait a minute. What do you think? What is the that you're referring to? You're saying negative campaigning or comparative campaigning or race? What's the that in that sense you're referring to?
Is there a D-box for all of the above? Mm. I mean, we're going to see this from super PACs. We may not see this strategy play out in May, but we may see something else come out in July. We will see something come out at the DNC in Charlotte where they have problems with unemployment. You have a very unpopular Democratic governor that only got into office by riding the Obama coattails, and she won't even run for re-election now. You're going to see a lot of these things coming into play moving forward. It may not be the strategy that got leaked to the media, but it will be something that's going to take advantage of the super PAC money that can create enough distance away from both candidates to allow them to do the dirty work while the candidates come in behind and benefit as a result.
We're talking with Lenny McAllister. He's a Republican strategist. And Michael Fauntleroy is author of the book Republicans and the Black Vote. He's a public policy professor at George Mason University. You know, we're talking about race and ethnicity, Professor Fauntleroy. There's news from the Census Bureau saying people of color now represent more than half of America's population under the age of one. That's 50.4%. And that's slight, but it is a first for this country. Estimates show that the numbers are only going to increase as minority birth rates will continue to exceed the birth rate of non-Hispanic whites in this country for years to come. So what do you think this means for our sort of political conversations? I mean, you're saying that this effort was an attempt to appeal to kind of white voters.
Fear.
Yes. So is this the last cycle in which that could even be possible or useful?
Well, first, this is not a surprise. The Census Bureau projections have for some time said that ultimately this would happen. So it's not a surprise. But I do find it curious that the reports are made or the statement is released at the same time we're talking about this Ricketts campaign or potential campaign. Because the truth of the matter is this kind of news feeds into the fear for certain white Americans that they're losing the country. And so going forward, I think it's just going to continue to polarize our politics in some respects. And as we look toward the future, political candidates, elected officials and others are going to have to shift the paradigm and shift the way in which they deal with different kinds of citizens because we're just going to be far more diverse than we've ever been before.
Lenny, what do you think? And I want to mention here that House Democrats introduced a bill that aiming to make voter registration easier for all Americans. They say this is necessary because they believe that there's a concerted effort on the part of Republicans to suppress the ability of minorities to vote, and they think that it's fear-based. Obviously, Republicans say they're just trying to protect the franchise. So what's your argument about how do you feel that this new demographic reality is going to affect our politics as briefly as you can?
Well, it should be a wake-up call to Republicans. It should be a second prong of a two-prong wake-up call for Republicans. The first one was the election of President Barack Obama from state senator to president within a matter of really 5 years. In 2002, he was a state senator in Illinois that was an underdog for the U.S. Senate race, and then by 2008, he's president-elect. This should be a wake-up call. He beat the establishment for that U.S. Senate seat. He beat the establishment to win the primary nomination for the Democrats against a former first lady, and now he won the presidency against a guy that was in the Senate for over – now he's going on over 30 years, roughly. So, one, race does matter. The new demographics of America does matter. And number two, Republicans, here you sit 4 years later, and although you may have some more people in office, you do have some people such as Alan West and Tim Scott, and you have Michael Williams running for Congress, and you have Stephanie Carter down there in the State House in Texas, and you have people such as Eugene Dokes here in Missouri running for the state house here. You have black Republicans, but if they're not making the inroads with black America and with minorities and young Americans to make them balance their perspectives on race, it still doesn't matter. This should not be something that scares Republicans into voter repression, which I don't think these new voter ID laws are.
Okay.
It should instead push us into proactivism to heal the relationships and the hurt from Southern strategy over the last three
okay.
to four decades.
All right.
And go into a new era.
We have to leave it there for now. That's Politics365.com senior contributor Lenny McAllister. We caught up with him in St. Louis, Missouri. He's speaking at the Rally for Common Sense there this weekend. Also with us, author and professor Michael Fauntroy. He was here in Washington, D.C. with me. He's a professor at George Mason University. Thank you so much for being with us, gentlemen.
Thank you. God bless you all.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, leaders of the G8, that's the group of eight highly industrialized nations, are meeting at Camp David this weekend, but they're also joined by the leaders of some emerging African countries who will discuss the issue of food security on the continent. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes. But first, we want to turn to a case that we've been following closely on this program. That's the shooting death of Trayvon Martin. He was the unarmed Florida teenager who was killed in February by self-appointed neighborhood watch volunteer George Zimmerman. George Zimmerman is facing second-degree murder charges. He's out on bail right now. But yesterday, a trove of information about the case and the investigation was made public for the first time. NPR's Greg Allen is based in Florida. He's been reviewing that, and he's with us now. Greg Allen, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. Hi, Michelle.
So what's jumped out to you as you've reviewed this material?
Well, you know, there's not a lot of stuff here that you didn't have some inkling about, but you start to get more of a complete picture, and you start to see what is going to be, you know, brought forward at trial. What are some of the conflicting stories you're going to hear? I thought, to me, the most compelling thing at first was this request that the Sanford police investigators prepared and put forward and sent to the state attorney back on March 13th. Excuse me. And that was a request for George Zimmerman to be arrested and charged with negligent homicide, manslaughter. And in that report, this was put together by Christopher Serino, the Sanford police investigator. He says that in there, he expresses some skepticism about Zimmerman. He says in his report, according to records checks, all of Zimmerman's suspicious persons calls while residing in the Retreat neighborhood have identified black males as a subject. And he says the encounter between George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin was ultimately avoidable by Zimmerman if Zimmerman had remained in his vehicle and awaited the arrival of law enforcement. And he says there's no indication that Trayvon Martin was involved in any criminal activity at the time of the encounter. So he's saying that he thought he should have been charged. And that was before, that was when Norman Wolfinger, the previous state attorney, still had it. He declined to act for whatever reason.
Now, this has been one of the issues that Trayvon Martin's family has talked about all along, which is why did George Zimmerman pursue him and why did he get out of the car? Now, I know that there are witness accounts or people who heard things, people who saw things. Do any of the witness accounts shed any light on why George Zimmerman got out of the car?
They don't, no. And, you know, what? Most of the witnesses actually got their attention when they heard the sounds of the fight. So most of the people, no one saw actually what created the actual fight and the physical altercation there, at least the witnesses who were in Sanford. There was a few different people who say there was a chase. They heard footsteps running. But most of those people weren't, none of those folks who in Sanford could say who was chasing whom. The one insight we get on that is from Trayvon Martin's girlfriend, who's not been named, but who was interviewed both by Benjamin Crump and then also by the state attorney's office. They went and talked to her in person, and she gave them a detailed description of the night. She talked to Trayvon Martin on and off all day long up to moments before his death, and she describes that first Zimmerman was in the car, and then she told Trayvon to run. He ran to run to his father's house. She said he was running to his father's house, going the back way. He had to stop running, she said, because he became too tired. She said, keep running, and he said, no, the other guy, Zimmerman, presumably, is too tired also. Eventually, Zimmerman catches up, and she's on the phone with Trayvon Martin at that time, and she says she hears a thump, and then after that, the phone went dead. So that would suggest that there was a pursuit and that Zimmerman was in the one who was doing the pursuing.
And on the other side of it, though, George Zimmerman has claimed self-defense, and I just want to play a cut of tape from another witness interview and ask for your thoughts. This is from a man who lived close to where the scuffle was taking place. Here it is.
The one guy on top in the black hoodie was pretty much just throwing down blows on the guy, kind of MMA style.
Ground and pound, okay.
Yeah, like a ground and pound on the concrete at this point. So at this point, I told him I was calling 911. I locked my door, went inside, heard a pop, never heard a gunshot before, so I didn't know if it was a rock or something like that. We ran upstairs. As soon as I got upstairs, I looked down below, and then I saw the guy in the black hoodie pretty much just laid out on the ground.
Now that seems to, I think one might argue that supports the George Zimmerman's version of events, which is that he was in fear for his life and safety at that point and that he was acting in self-defense. Do investigators offer any narrative around that?
No, they don't around that, and I think you're exactly right. That if there is material here that does bolster Zimmerman's defense, and that is a key part of it. That witness, his townhouse was right next to where the altercation took place. He was watching television with his fiancée. He came outside and saw much of the fight going forward, and he had more descriptions. He's been interviewed several times by various investigators, and always gave pretty much the same story that the person on top appeared to be Trayvon Martin, and he was raining down blows upon George Zimmerman, and they're on the concrete at that point. And, you know, of course, then later we have photos and medical personnel's reports saying that George Zimmerman did have his nose broken and had a couple of lacerations on the back of his head. And on that, there's also a question about who was calling for help. And that's an interesting question.
That is an interesting question, too. And there are also, I want to mention that there are other interviews where two people who are not identified say that they thought Zimmerman was acting strangely and were pretty adamant that he's in the wrong. Not clear about why that is, because also there's an autopsy report that was done on Trayvon Martin that showed that there were some controlled substances in his system. So, Greg, before we let you go, very briefly, is there anything that has not been released that people who are closely following this case would find compelling and important?
Well, of course, the most compelling stuff we have not heard or seen is the interviews with George Zimmerman. Those are protected under Florida law. All this stuff is made public under Florida law if you give a public records request. But Zimmerman's account, his interviews are protected because they could be construed as confessions. And under Florida law, any confession, if someone is charged, then is not made public. So that's why we haven't seen those. And that will be a key to this case, of course.
And we will keep following it. And we appreciate you. NPR's Greg Allen has been covering the Trayvon Martin case closely. He was with us from his home office in Miami. Now we want to talk about new international efforts to address the issue of hunger in Africa. Representatives of 8 of the world's largest economies, the G8 countries, are meeting today, as they do every year, to talk about economic and strategic issues. This year, President Obama is hosting the meeting at Camp David, and he's also invited the leaders of Benin, Ethiopia, Ghana, and Tanzania to talk about ways to move towards food security across the continent of Africa, which has some of the world's fastest-growing economies, but also still struggles with food insecurity in many places. Today, the president announced $3 billion in private sector pledges aimed at alleviating hunger, and he also pressed other donor countries to make good on previous pledges. We wanted to talk more about this, so we called Jada McKenna. She's the Deputy Coordinator for Development for Feed the Future. That's the U.S. government's Global Hunger and Food Security Initiative. It's run out of USAID. Also with us, Mwiza Muntali, Public Outreach Director for TransAfrica. That's an advocacy organization that promotes diversity and equity in foreign policy and places a particular focus on Africa and the Caribbean. Welcome to you both. Thank you both
so much for speaking. Thank you so much for having us.
Jada, let me start with you. Food security is one of the main items on the agenda at the G8 summit today. Can you just talk a little bit more about what exactly you think will be discussed?
Yes. As you know, the G8 leaders have a lot of pressing issues to discuss, such as creating jobs for our economies and stability. But it's really important to note that the leaders are taking almost 2 hours of their session to focus exclusively on Africa with the African leaders you mentioned. And that topic will focus 100% on this issue of food security.
Why those particular countries?
So
if we know
many African nations have really been a leader in teaching us how to come out of hunger in the past few years and have done some of the most innovative work. But these countries in particular, Ghana, Tanzania and Ethiopia, and the president of Benin is also there in his role as president of the African Union. But those three countries have been particularly innovative and aggressive in solving hunger. And they've been particularly active in working to bring in the private sector and having this as a long term pathway to growth that includes women and small farmers who are at the heart of the poverty in their countries.
Mwiza, let me turn to you. I think the question I would have is, why is there still food insecurity on the African continent?
Part of it is management. Both indigenous governments, but also the international community's policies. I think one of the biggest challenges of the G8 is that they've made a lot of promises before, not been delivered, sadly.
Well, could you talk a little bit more about that? Because I am sure there are people who are listening to our conversation who will say that other continents, other places around the world have mastered the food security problem, but it continues to be a long-term problem in Africa. And they might say to themselves, what role really do we have as part of the international community in addressing this beyond food aid, which is something that you were skeptical of? So could you talk a little bit more about that?
The international community has a huge role. I mean, when you look at the biggest problem, I think we always come into this issue is in the middle. We don't look at the fundamental structures of the international trade policies, international agricultural policies, of why even these countries exist. The main reason why they existed was they were colonized, and during those times, they were designed to grow a specific crop. Like Kenya, for instance, you had a whole bunch of tea plantations. Ghana, you have cocoa. And so a lot of the agricultural sector is still in the framework of that colonial system.
For export. It's designed for export, not necessarily to feed the continent itself.
And things you necessarily can't eat. And that's why it's difficult to talk about this issue in just a one soundbite. And then the other problem, you also have countries like China are coming in, buying up land for their own population, which is also affecting negatively for the local population. So you have these complicated issues, and the G8 has to look at it more holistically and not just a food aid, which is not really going to solve the problem.
I think one thing I wanted to address, something that Mwiza said, it's really important. This year's G8 discussion is not about food aid. It's about smarter investments and working with the African countries to make long-term changes so that food aid isn't necessary going forward. It really is about how they work with the private sector and how they work with donors to drive that long-term agricultural growth in the rural communities so that we don't need food aid, so that people are more resilient to the droughts and the floods that we know are going to come.
Mwiza, could you give us an example of something you feel gives a sense of the kind of policy direction that you would like to see the international community take, since you are an advocate? Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask you to advocate for a minute.
People have been farming for centuries, but the biggest problem has been the governments have not done a good job of talking to the small farmers, of seeing what their needs are. So I think they need to be brought more into the table as the G8 discusses this issue.
Jada, I'm going to ask you to give us the final word. I think many of us have been talking about food insecurity in Africa throughout our entire adult lives. Mm-hmm. I don't know about you. I remember as a child talking about collecting money in UNICEF for Biafra.
Yes.
And so I'd like to ask, will our children still be talking about this? Or do you envision that the question of food security will be addressed in our lifetime?
We think this is a solvable challenge, and that's exactly why we're devoting the whole session to it. There was a very successful green revolution in the 50s and 60s that went across Latin America and South Asia, and now it is Africa's time to do that. African farmers, they want choices. They should be able to choose between having an organic farm or using modern technologies, and they want to be able to provide a better future for their children. They want to be able to do less work by hand. And so working together, working with companies, both local companies and also international companies. They want to be able to work with them, and their governments want that investment. They want that local investment. They want that international investment because they know that's what their smallholders need for sustainable business, and so that they're not continually relying on subsidies or foreign aid. And so that's what we are going to accomplish. This will be a thing of the past.
Jada McKenna is USAID's Deputy Coordinator for Development at Feed the Future. Mwiza Muntali is the Public Outreach Director for TransAfrica. That's an advocacy organization to promote diversity and equity in foreign policy, with a particular focus on the African world and the Caribbean. And they were both kind enough to join us from our studios here in Washington, D.C. Thank you both so much for speaking.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And now we want to offer a tribute to a great voice in American music who died this week. Donna Summer passed away on Thursday of cancer. She was 63 years old. Born LaDonna Adrian Gaines, Donna Summer became the queen of disco in the 1970s, winning 5 Grammys. With her big voice and glittery style, she defined disco for many fans, and anybody who's been to a wedding or school dance over the last 30 years knows at least one of her songs, including hits like Hot Stuff, On the Radio, Love to Love You Baby, or Last Dance.
Last dance, last chance for love. Yes, it's my last chance for romance tonight.
That was Last Dance from Donna Summer in 1978. We wanted to talk more about the disco diva, so we've called Mark Anthony Neal. He is a professor at Duke University's African American Studies Department. He teaches Black popular culture. Welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us.
How you doing, Michelle?
So what makes a Donna Summer song a Donna Summer song?
It's a couple of things. It's sex and it's disco. She was, as you mentioned, the queen of disco, and with her very first single, at least here in the United States, with Giorgio Moroder, you know, Love to Love You Baby, that combination came together. And, you know, and folks forget, when she enters the scene in 1975, you know, Aretha Franklin is kind of passing the torch off to Natalie Cole, and Donna Summers comes from out of nowhere, and she came with that kind of Euro disco sound, which was a little impersonal and a little tinny and a little machine-like, and she went to the top of the charts with that.
You know, it's interesting. You pointed something out that I was wondering about. As we reached out on Facebook and asked people if they wanted to tell us memories of Donna Summer, we got comments from people as far away as India. And there are people from literally all over the world, all ages. Let me just play one and then you can tell me what you think. Here it is. This is a comment from listener John Book.
To me, Donna Summer had a very strong voice and could bring on any emotion into what she sang. If she wrote it, people felt it. If she didn't, she made you believe she lived those experiences. On one end, she could talk about being a bad girl who was all about the hot stuff, but turn around and speak of her independence.
Okay, John Book. Well, what do you think?
It was a classic pop voice. You know, she didn't have the kind of gospel power that we heard from folks like Aretha, but her voice was actually much more stronger than someone like Diana Ross, and she was malleable. I mean, she could sing all kinds of music. I mean, that was the thing that's actually a kind of detriment to our memory of her when she decided to leave disco alone, as America left disco alone, and she tried to branch out into other forms of music. You know, folks kind of lost track of her, but she could sing anything. You know, at the time of her death, she had talked about she wanted to do an album of standards, and she clearly had the talent and skill to be able to pull that off.
Is there a song of hers that you wish more people knew and appreciated?
I think of Dim All the Lights as a song that was on her incredible double album, Bad Girls. It comes out in 1979. And it's a song that's kind of harks back to an R&B roots in her career. We don't think of her as a soul and R&B artist, but Dim All the Lights is really the song that gets us closest to that aesthetic, you know, for folks listening to her in the 1970s.
Okay, well, we'll play a little bit of that, but this is from her 1999 live album from VH1 Presents. Mark Anthony Neal is a professor in the African American Studies Department at Duke University. He has a particular expertise in Black popular culture. He was with us from member station WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Professor Neal, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week, our freelance journalist Jimmy Israel. He's with us from Cleveland. Here in Washington, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar. Also here in our D.C. studio, Johns Hopkins political science professor and blogger Lester Spence, and syndicated columnist Ruben Navarrete. He's in from San Diego. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas, welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Hey, my man.
Doing good, man.
Hey, shucky hey. Ducky.
All righty then.
Step away from the Red Bull.
Right. Well, you know what? Just a few days after President Obama announced his support for same-sex marriage, Newsweek magazine created a buzz with this kind of provocative cover. You'll remember it shows President Obama with a rainbow halo around his head, and the headline, "The First Gay President." Kind of reminds me when Toni Morrison knighted Bill Clinton, the first black president. Lester Spence, the good doctor, you've been blogging about this. Politically, what do you think President Obama's same-sex marriage announcement, what do you think it means?
Well, I think it means that for the first time, not really for the first time, but it really gives gays and lesbians and people who support them increased political capital to actually fight for marital rights, right? I mean, so we think of marriage as kind of a thing that people do, but there are like 1,200 state and federal benefits that come with marriage that people who are married, that that people who want to engage in same-sex marriages cannot actually have, right? So just him saying that he supports it gives them increased political capital to fight. Now, there are some concerns that he may lose support from, say, African Americans, for example. But the reality is that black...
Yeah, that'll happen.
Yeah, but no, the reality is that black people, black attitudes on this issue are really changing, and that's unlikely to happen. This is really a great day.
I've always thought the whole meme about black people being homophobic. I always thought that was overblown. Ruben Navarrete, you've said before in the shop that black folks vote against same-sex marriage when the issue comes up at the polls. Okay, yeah. Well, do you think this will change anything?
Well, they are not alone. Latinos also vote. A majority of Latinos voted against gay marriage on the day they voted for Barack Obama to be president in 2008. There's a paradox for you. A number of African Americans in California, the majority of African Americans in California on that same night went to the polls, elected Barack Obama to be president, voted against gay marriage. So those two communities have had that issue. It's taken me a while. 10 years ago, I was on that train of folks who believed in a civil union and didn't like the idea of gay marriage. But for the last 10 years, I've been in favor of gay marriage. And it really is a tough issue for a lot of politicians to come down on. I don't think the president went far enough, and I'm not alone in that regard. A lot of folks... if you saw Barbara Walters interview him on The View, she was trying to pin him down as to more of a commitment in terms of what are you prepared to do as president. You're not just some taxi driver. You know, you don't just teach, you know, college. You don't just write a column. What is it that you're prepared to do as president to put words to actions to your words? And he wouldn't be pinned down. All he says is, I support gay marriage. I support the idea of it. But he hasn't said that he would help repeal DOMA, you know, the Defense of Marriage Act. And this is, again, Barbara Walters isn't alone in trying to pin him down and trying to get more out of him. I just think this is words. And unfortunately, in this administration, we've seen time and again, they think words and actions are interchangeable. They think words are just as good as actions.
Yeah, but Ruben, let me ask this, Ruben, two things here. Yeah. First of all, you're also the same guy who's also telling him to set his priorities. I mean, this has been your ongoing theme here. It's about the economy. And why are you diverting from that? That should be your priority. And every time he's done something other than that, you've criticized him for not setting priorities. So, number one, I want to know what's up with that. And number two, I wanted to ask you on a personal level. You said that you were kind of civil marriage, yes, marriage, no, 10 years ago. I'm curious about what changed your mind.
Well, I'll tell you, I want to take on the second part first, but I think with regard to his priorities, I said all along he'd have had a much smoother presidency if he had focused on the economy like a laser in the first term, and then the first year of the term, And because people would have said, well, even if he didn't make it, even if he wasn't able to make a dent in it, at least he tried. And I think that it took him too long to get to that, and I've said that before. But I think the gay community is saying you can walk and chew gum at the same time. You've said you come in and taken our money. You know, you have these bundlers who go into the gay community. They want something in return for that, and they hope that this is sort of going to help them along those lines. But they have been very unhappy with this president, as you know, up to this point, because they think that he is actually evolving in the other direction. Now, I started off against gay marriage and ended up more in favor of it. He's been sort of reversed when you look at what he did in the Illinois legislature. What changed my mind is this basic idea that family members of mine who are gay should have the same rights to be married as I do. And when you see it as a case of marriage equality and just liberty, freedom, like everybody else having the same freedom as the person next door, I think it's much harder to run against mm-hmm. it than when you see it as a religious institution and the idea of marriage being special and between a man and a woman. So for me, it's about equality and it's about liberty, and that's where I've arrived.
Hey, Jimmy, can Arsalan jump in here? He's dying.
Okay.
He's jumping out of his chair.
Go ahead, A-Train.
Well, you know, fellas, you know who's not getting enough props in this whole thing is Uncle Joe Biden. Oh, you know, let's not forget that Vice President Joe Biden went on the Sunday talk show, not only coming out publicly in support of gay marriage, but, you know, throwing the Will and Grace reference in there. But, you know, that really was the impetus that brought this about. And so I'm waiting for Vice President Biden to start, you know, dropping dimes about, you know, decriminalizing marijuana or closing Guantanamo Bay.
Joe is the gift that keeps on
indefinite detention.
But, you know, the interesting thing, you know, as a civil rights lawyer, what I always tell people is that in America, under our constitutional system, the protection of the civil rights of one person is the protection of the civil rights of everyone. And the example I always give is the landmark Supreme Court decision of Brown versus the Board of Education, which was about a 7-year-old little black girl in Kansas who could not go to the school next door to her. But the landmark decision actually became the legal precedent for Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which protects every single American from employment discrimination. Yeah. So we have to understand that even though we might not be gay or we might not be an immigrant, we have to understand that the protection of the civil rights of one American is the protection of all American mm-hmm. civil rights.
Jimmy wants to.
Can I get this out right quick? Ruben, you were said something about our black and brown brothers going to the polls and voting down gay marriage. You know, I want to clarify something. We don't believe it's a racial thing so much as we believe it's a religion thing. Yeah, I mean, do we agree about that?
I think no doubt religion is a big part of it with regard to.
I think
the
religion is the part of it.
And I don't think it can be justified. I don't think you can hide behind religion when you say that a group of people should be disenfranchised. Living in California, when that ballot initiative Prop 8 was on the ballot, it was pretty clear. This was an attempt to disenfranchise a segment of the California population. And it was almost a 50-50 vote. It was so incredibly close, right? So incredibly close. And it was a big disappointment to me personally that a majority of Latinos who don't need lectures on being discriminated against were on the wrong side, and a majority of African Americans were on the wrong side.
I don't know how you call something so fundamental to people's being as religion for some people is hiding behind it. I mean, you wouldn't say you can't hide behind your sexuality. You can't hide behind your intellect. I mean, if that is fundamental to who you are, how do you call it hiding behind as opposed to a profound belief that has to be engaged?
I'm having trouble with the community. I'm having trouble with a community that has typically during the civil rights movement gone to the church as a focal point of a movement for equality, then coming back to the same church as somehow a focal point for an attempt to deny equality to another group of people. It doesn't work that way, and it doesn't sound good when it's coming from Latinos. It doesn't sound good when it's coming from African Americans. Now, African Americans who are gay and Latinos who are gay have been saying this for some time, that it's particularly hurtful that their communities are not in their corner. So what I'm saying here is that the president can talk all he wants, but there's a lot of folks out there who want to see some serious action and they want to see.
But that is the same thing is true of religious minorities, like people who belong to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or perhaps people who are conservative Jewish people. I mean, those are also religious minorities in this country who also may have a deep and profound belief that marriage should take on a certain form. And nobody turns to them and say, "How could you say that?"
I mean, if you're Jewish or you're a Mormon and you know what it's like to be discriminated against, where do you get off discriminating against somebody else?
Has the gay community made any bridges to the people of communities of color that I'm not aware of? Any substantial bridges to the people of color that I'm not aware of? I'm just curious. I'm gonna put that out there because I keep hearing this conversation about what black people and brown people are supposed to do, but you know there can't be any generosity without reciprocity.
You know, Jimmy, you know there's just we're living it right now. We have this very ugly history with regard to the Unity Conference. You know, the Unity Conference bringing together the African-American, Latino, Asian-American
I know all about
journalists,
it,
the whole story, right? Well, you know about the latest wrinkle. The fact is that when it was opened up to gay and lesbian journalists, okay, there was one group that defected, and that was the group of black journalists.
That wasn't
defected.
The only reason. That's not the reason. Well, I'm sorry.
You're going inside baseball
that,
now.
I'm sorry. Just as a matter of record, it's a very minor issue, but secondly, it was not about LGBT journalists. It was about financial issues and a sense of the financial burden, because NABJ happens to be the largest association. I'm sure three people care about that, including us, but I just feel that that's just not accurate. Well, anyway, we need to move on. I'm sorry, John. This is a really rich and important discussion, but there are other things that I know Jimmy wanted to talk about. So in our weekly barbershop roundtable with freelance journalist Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar, syndicated columnist Ruben Navarrete, and political science professor Lester Spence. I know Ruben is so shy today. I don't know. What can we do to bring him out of the show?
Move the coffee away from Ruben.
But, you know, talking about can we all get along on a lighter note,
these two popular
New Jersey leaders teamed up on this video spoof this week. It was for kind of their legislative follies, or a lot of state legislatures have this kind of tradition where they do some sort of a dinner. It's supposed to encourage people to, you know, get along. Can I just play a short clip of
it? Yeah, drop it.
Do you want to hear it? Okay, here it is.
You guys got any problems you want me to handle? Like a fire anywhere? People trapped?
No.
Like a bad automobile accident where you need me to help some folks?
No, nothing like that.
You need me the cat in a tree?
No, I think we're all set here.
Trooper, what do we got?
Mayor, thank you for coming. There's a 2-alarm fire down on State Street. We do have a car broken down on Route 1. And yes, a little girl has lost her cat in a tree.
All right, Trooper, as you were, Governor, I got this.
Anyway, the deal is that this plays off Cory Booker. His real-life reputation as a hands-on mayor who literally just did, in fact, save a neighbor who was in a burning building.
That's right.
Governor Christie is, trying to get in on that. Not to his success. So I don't know. I'm wondering what you guys think about that. Well, I don't know. Jimmy, what do you think?
You know what? I saw the video and I was like, overall, the mise-en-scene was kind of reminiscent of Wes Anderson circa The Life Aquatic. The multiple camera style kind of shot right to digital. I dug it. You know, it looked expensive but exhaustive to edit. It was well acted mostly, but not funny enough for me. And for a lot of other people, I think, kind of sticking the zeitgeist in any substantial way. And I don't think it's going to change anybody's political mind either.
I understood words of that. But anyway, Arsalan, including
No, I loved the video. And what's interesting for me, living here in Washington, D.C., you know, having to deal with Beltway politics, it shows how hyper-partisan our country has become here in Washington, D.C. It reminds me of a conversation that I had a few months ago with Clarence Page, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist from the Chicago Tribune, where he said, you know, Arsalan, I've covered D.C. for 35 years. And the level of vitriol, you know, back in the 80s, Arlen Specter and Ted Kennedy would yell at each other on the Senate floor and then go play a round of golf afterwards. He's like, I just don't see that as being possible today. And what I saw with the Booker Christie video was that, you know, at the state and local level, you know, people are crossing party lines in a way that they're just not doing here. And it really, really brought that to light for me.
Lester, what do you think?
Yeah, along those same lines, though, you have to remember the relationship between a governor and a mayor. A governor of a big city mayor is different, right? So Coleman Young, the first black mayor of Detroit, he worked really, really closely with William Milliken, who was a governor of Michigan during the first couple of terms. So I think it's a good video. We have to understand that. But we have to make sure that we don't make the leap and say, okay, wow, I wish our D.C. politics was more like this.
Because it's different.
Yeah, how people engage in personally has absolutely no effect on these really substantial political differences. I wouldn't necessarily want, say, for example, somebody far, far on the left, like John Conyers. I wouldn't want John Conyers to hang out with Ryan before
Paul Ryan,
or after.
Budget committee chair. Yeah, really?
Paul Ryan.
You don't want them to hang out? You don't think a game of bowling could smooth things over a little bit?
No. What it does is it leads to like a beer summit view of politics. Right, where the only thing where what we need to have people do is get together and talk it out and then just, you know, kind of smooth out differences. No, these are deep, enduring political differences that we need conflict to reconcile.
That's interesting. Ruben,
And Lester gets to why I thought it would be more useful to just have a craft critique of the piece rather than talk about it politically, because there's nothing else there to talk about.
Yeah, so. it's a nice gesture. I like the idea of people coming across party lines. I get the difference with the governor and mayor's relationship. But I just had a much warmer feel for the actual event. If you remember how Mayor Cory Booker handled himself at the press day that day, they're all trying to call him a hero and everything else.
Oh, yeah.
And he just, in a very class act, very classy, said, you know what, I just did what anybody else would do. Yeah. And I flash back to that. I thought that was a much more, you know, sophisticated and respectful way of dealing with it.
It was a very profound event. Actually, we talked to him right after that. After he did his neighbor to safety, and it was a very profound
the way he handled
event.
It.
You all remember that. Okay, before we let you go, you know I can't say goodbye without getting those NBA, the playoff picks, you know, have to do it. Arsalan is doing his happy dance because, Arsalan, you're our man here. Who do you pick to win it all? And
well, I mean, you know,
why do we even ask this?
Well, I mean, you know, with this condensed NBA season, you know, Derrick Rose is out of the playoffs. Dwight Howard's been out of the playoffs. You know, Chris Bosh of the Miami Heat is out indefinitely. We don't know when he's coming back. You know, so in the East, it kicks open the door for my beloved Boston Celtics to potentially make their one last run of their big three of, you know, Paul the Truth Pierce, Ray Jesus Shuttlesworth Allen, and Kevin Big Ticket Garnett, who's just turning back the clock. But in the West, I think that's the San Antonio Spurs and Oklahoma City Thunder are the two best teams in the NBA. It's kind of sad that they're going to have to duke it out to actually play somebody from the East in the finals, but I think it's going to be San Antonio and Boston. I got to pick my Boston Celtics in six games.
I am shocked by that.
I know,
now,
right?
Lester, you know, your Pistons are out, so are you still watching?
Yeah, so you didn't let me, you know, normally I just say Detroit. It doesn't matter, right?
No matter
but, yeah, I think if Bosh doesn't get healthy, I think it probably will be Boston and San Antonio. And I think it'll be San Antonio.
Okay, Ruben, what you like?
I'm going to pull for San Antonio. I would lay a shout-out to my friend Julian Castro, the mayor out there. Pull for him. But, you know, I'm agnostic on basketball. Bring back football season. Let's get going.
No wings for you. Jimmy, you're a Cleveland man. You know your Cavaliers lost LeBron James to the Miami Heat ahead of last season. The Heat fell in the finals last year to the Mavericks. So what do you call it this time?
You know what? I got to say sorry to my man Scott Rabb. I got to rock with the Heat, you know, because, you know, LeBron's got a lot to prove. He's Mr. MVP. You know, it's all in the shoes that came out, and they're just sweet. So if he can't win in those shoes, he can't win.
Hey, I know what I want for Christmas. Jimmy Israel is a freelance journalist and presidential fellow at Case Western Reserve University. He was with us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Ruben Navarrete is a syndicated columnist who writes for the Washington Post Writers Group, Latino Magazine, and CNN.com, with us from San Diego. Lester Spence is a blogger and political science professor at Johns Hopkins University. And Arsalan Iftikhar is a civil rights attorney and founder of the Muslim Guide.com. Arsalan and Lester here with me in Washington, D.C. Thank you all so much.
Peace.
Peace.
Thank you.
Yep, yep.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more on Monday.